We are going to look at two different midrashim today. So, Dershuni, we've been studying Dershuni, if you're just joining us, is modern Israeli women's midrash. And in particular, I've been pulling midrashim all along a theme that I'm calling a God who knows women. What would it look like to have to really feel like God actually understands? Not just that we understand God's gender, but that God understands our gender. And I would say these two midrashim are really on theme for that. And they ask sort of different questions. Today we're going to look at two midrashim, and they are both written by Tamar Biala. So Tamar Biala is the editor of the Dirshuni collection. And we have looked at her midrashim, I think the first week. The Miriam Midrash that we looked at was hers. In the second week, we looked at one Midrash that was hers and one that was someone else's. And today, actually, both of the Midrashim that we're going to look at are coming from Tamar Biala. So you'll see some of her themes and some of her questions emerge. And the theme that I would put into both of these Midrashim, it's like clear this is something that Tamar is thinking a lot about, is what is God waiting on us for? Okay, so not just a question of like, what do we need from God, but also, is there something that God is waiting for from us? And what responsibility do we have around that? And we're going to read these two very different midrashim. She has two very different answers to that. I've said that sometimes midrashim and Dirshuni really look and sound like classical midrashim, and sometimes they sound different. Tamar's tend to sound more like short story-ish. I would say the first one we're going to read today, which is actually on the Ten Commandments, which is a theme that we covered a little bit last week also, like what was the role of women at Sinai, and is Sinai the right way for women to experience revelation? Last week we talked about versus childbirth. This midrash of hers, I think, is the most far along on the spectrum of it sounds like a short story more than a midrash. If it is a short story, if that's the genre in your mind, I would say it has a little bit of like magical realism fantasy. Like, is this a little bit of a fantasy of like what Tamar is imagining here? So we'll read it together, but you can sort of put in your mind that question in your mind. And this midrash is going to talk about a sort of central question that has come up in Jewish history, which is a question of, were the women at Sinai, right? What were the women doing at Sinai? We have ancient classical answers to this. We have modern poetic answers to this. We have Judith Plaskow's book, Standing Again at Sinai, is a question of like, oh, how do we write ourselves back into the story? Merle Felt has a beautiful poem about this imagination of the women were there. They just didn't get to write it down because their hands were full with babies. It's a beautiful image. So this is sort of Tamar's approach to that question. We'll read in the English and then I'll hop over to the Hebrew to sort of make comments.
Okay, this is the Giving of the Ten Commandments, Tamar Biala. This is the story of a young woman who was sitting in the synagogue while the Ten Commandments were being read. The reader was chanting so expertly that the young woman felt it was as though she was hearing them for the first time. And she was astonished at what she heard, and her heart became aggrieved.
Okay. This is the picture we have here. The first word in the Hebrew is ma'aseh. So this is a story, sounds like a funny way to start a story, right? Like once upon a time. But actually, this is sort of a Talmudic rabbinic language of saying like ma'aseh be'alma, like this is a story of a young woman, is actually like a rabbinic turn of phrase for starting a story. So there's a story of a young woman, but the thing that makes this feel so modern is that she's sitting bebeit ha'knesset, right? She's sitting in shul and she's listening to a laner. Okay, so this feels actually like it's set maybe now. It doesn't feel like some of the other midrashim that feel like they are set in an ancient time or, discussing something ancient. Here, and also many of Tamar's midrashim are set in a Beit Midrash. Here, it feels like we are in shul, right? We're set in shul. And the reader is chanting the Torah so expertly that she feels as though she is hearing the words for the first time. So I just want to say, like, this resonates so much with me. I don't know if you have had this experience where, like, sometimes you'll be listening or like reading in the Torah and for some reason the words land differently with you, right? And you have this thought like, Did it say that last year? Like that sentence wasn't there last year. There's no way. There's no way that was in there last year, right? And it's like, for some reason, even though this is presumably a woman who has sat in shul many times, this is the first time there is something about the Lehner, right? He's so makpid. He's so particular and careful, is the Hebrew here, in the way that they're reading, that she hears these Ten Commandments for the first time, and it makes her heart aggrieved. This word in the Hebrew, like, is like ma'im akrim, is sort of like foggy or murky, like it's a word you would use to describe water. That's what's happening in her heart. You're going to see a lot of heart. Like, I went through my version of this midrash, and I just like put little hearts every time that she has the word lev. Beliba, in her heart, it comes all throughout this midrash. Okay, so read the next paragraph for us.
She asked in her heart, what is the nature of remember the Shabbat to hallow it from Shemot? Of which it is said, you shall do no work, you and your son and your daughter, your male slave, your slave girl, and your beast, and your sojourner who is within your gates, and his wife. What about her? Is she not commanded to hallow the Shabbat?
Okay, so here we have the libah. She's thinking to herself, which is her way of asking in her heart. And what's the thing she is noticing? This is where we get lost a little bit in the English, right? Because what she's noticing is a grammatical detail. Lo ta'asa kol malacha ata uvincha ubitecha, right? This is second person male singular language. So the main takeaway we need here, like what she's hearing, is like, not me. This commandment about Shabbat seems to be not for me, right? And then she's a little bit startled by that. Like, wait, what? How could this be not for me?
And what is the nature of you shall not covet, of which it is said, you shall not covet your fellow man's wife, or his male slave, or his slave girl, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that your fellow man has, from chapter 20. And his wife, what about her? Did the Torah not command her too, not to covet that which is her fellow woman's?
Okay, so again, I think what we're meant to be looking at here in particular is the grammar, right? This is directed at the men, and she is saying, like, well, what about me? Am I not a part of this? Like, do women not have feelings? Again, she has this heart, very active heart. And here she's, you know, that maybe women aren't included in this commandment about not coveting.
The young woman was pious, and not until that day had she had a single foreign musing or doubt regarding the truth of the Torah. At this moment of questioning, her heart was wrapped in fear, beating and beating, until she thought everyone in the synagogue could hear its rhythm. The tears that rose in her throat had the taste of the deep and the taste of the sea that drowned the Egyptians. And she was shaking and aghast, and her soul fled off.
Okay, so let's see what happens here. First of all, she is a tzedeket. It says, the translation says pious, which I think is accurate, but there is also like, she's a tzaddik, maybe. I think there's some reference here to the story of Tamar. Yehuda says tzadka mimeni, like she is more righteous than I. So it's like, we know she's a tzedeket, she's righteous. But I also think there's a way to read this a little bit as like tzedeket, like, by the way, she was right. By the way, I just want you to know, she is right, like tzedeket is correct here. So all of that is sort of like in who she is. And there is something interesting here, right, about saying like, she's never had a doubt before. So part of this, I feel like it's like, oh, we take these critiques more seriously sometimes. That maybe the story is trying to say like, and she wasn't angry just because she was an angry feminist. Like, that's not the case. Like, she never doubted anything before, right? This is actually a righteous woman who's believed everything she's been taught. And she has basically a breakdown, right? She has some sort of existential crisis here. I also like, this also speaks to me. I feel like I've had experiences like this. I don't know if you have, where if you've ever been in, like, you're in a synagogue or you're in a lecture, or like, and the rabbi is saying something or the Torah is saying something, and you feel suddenly so strongly that, like, you feel like your heart is beating out of your chest, and you wonder, like, can everyone around me tell? Like, can't, why isn't everyone else upset? Like, why am I the only one having this experience? That she is sort of looking around and she's feeling like, I'm surrounded by people, and also, like, I can't tell if they are with me or if, like, my heart is beating so fast, maybe they can even see it. There's something really visceral. And then as her sort of crisis builds, she has tears. I've talked about how Tamar Biala almost always has tears, and the tears are always like something much more than sadness. So here we have fear. Her heart was wrapped in fear. And the tears have both the taste of the deep and the taste of the sea that drowned the Egyptians. Her tears both have creation and redemption in them. Like, those are some intense tears. I think these are, like, very intentional images that she has here, that she is able to, like, experience both creation and redemption as, yeah, or creation and destruction that are so sort of simultaneously together. But all together here, she has this sort of like panic, and it builds. And then we don't know what this, like, what does this mean, parchadate, right? Like, her soul fled. She fainted. There is some kind of like severing that happens here. This is sort of like where we're going to go into the like dream state.
The Holy Blessed One gathered up her soul in the palm of her hand, of his hand, and was looking and smiling at her. He said to her, "How long have I waited for you to come and ask me, so that I might reveal to you that which has been hidden away with me for 3,000 years? She cast her eyes downward and asked, "Did the Holy One, Blessed One, not speak with women at Mount Sinai and not command them the same things he commanded men with thunder and lightning?"
Okay, here's the fantasy. The fantasy is that God gathers her up in the palm of his hand. I think of two images here. First of all, like, the this gathering, you know, asif is such a profound image, but it makes me think of like the line in Tachanun that we say, where we say, like, you know, let me fall into God's hand, as like nipana la bayada donai, like, let me fall into God's hand as opposed to man's hand, is that she gets to sort of, she gets to do that. Like, she gets to pass out, and the person that catches her is God, right? The Holy Blessed One catches her in this moment. That's very profound. I also think of like Noah, like the calf, like Noah reaches his hand out and like takes in the bird. It's like God sort of reaching out and like pulls her back in, which to me, it's just this image of like her soul could have departed and like flown away. And it could be like, that's the end of Tamar Biala. She had a spiritual crisis and she became an atheist and she's gone now, right? But instead, like, God reaches out and like pulls her back in. So I feel like that image is so striking. And then, of course, we get this mechayech. God is smiling at her, right? So, okay, I think it was you saying, right? It's like, there's this fear of like, uh-oh, am I the enemy? Did I turn on God, right? And here, it's like, what do we need when we have questions like this? The thing we need most is like, okay, God is smiling at her, right? God is not only smiling, but God says, how long have I waited for you to come and ask me this question, right? And the ask in the Hebrew here is not just any kind of question. It's a kashya. It's a halachic question, right? That God is like, but first of all, it's a challenge, but it's also like a halachic question. And a kashya is like a sanctioned question. Right? Akashia is the kind of question that you're meant to ask when you are within the world of like machloket l'shem shemaim, you know, of like being in the game. So God says, this is what I've been waiting for. These are the grand question I want us to take through these two midrashim is, what is God waiting for from us, right? So here, God, here's the answer. Just, you know. I'm giving it away to you. Here's the answer, right? God says, how long have I waited for you to come and ask me this so that I might reveal to you what's been hidden away with me for 3,000 years? Okay, so she's presenting us an image of God saying, I have answers to this, and I've been waiting for you to ask the question, right? So not only does her question become not a problem, actually, her question is an integral part of Revelation, right? She gets to be part of Revelation because God is going to reveal this next part. You know, God has more to reveal. Revelation wasn't done, actually. And God says, thank God you asked. Now I get to reveal this more to you, and I've been waiting. So she sort of like sheepishly gets to ask her question, like, hey, were the women there? Were we a part of that thunder and that lightning? Again, the thunder and the lightning part in the question make me think of the midrash that we learned last week about comparing the intimacy of childbirth to like the sort of big public supernatural. And she's like, hey, am I a part of that big public supernatural thing? That's her question. So this is sort of a delightful little paragraph. Regardless of how you feel about what came before, what happens next, there's something I think this to me is like really the heart of this midrash.
The Holy Blessed One lifted up her head and said, when Moses ascended, I commanded him, and have them make themselves ready for the third day. And on the third day, God will come down before all the people on Mount Sinai. It's from Exodus 19. Since Moses distanced himself from women, for he separated from his wife Zipporah, he brought only men near the mountain, as it said, and Moses brought the people toward God from the camp.
Okay. So here's a question. I have a question. I'm curious what you think. Is this like an explanation, or is it an excuse, or an explanation, or an indictment, or a critique? Like, what's happening in this answer? But like, first, let's just get the tachlis of what is happening here. Okay, God first of all lifts her head up. Right, her head was down. God's like, chin up. You don't have to be afraid. We can have this conversation. And God says, okay, here's what happened. I told Moses, all the people, kol ha'am, but Moses only brought ha'am. So this is actually the same sort of linguistic thing that the classical midrash will also pick up on, kol ha'am and am. But here, the point she's making is like Moses, because Moses chose to distance himself from Zipporah, and therefore, Moses brought only the men near the mountain.
And at that time, when Moses heard the commandments and there were only men around him, he heard, you shall do no work, and said to himself, and who will be punished for doing work if not the man? And whose are the slaves and the slave girls, chattel and children, whom he can command to do work or to rest, if not the man?
Okay, so here, so the first part is the explanation of like, well, here's how it ended up that there were no women around. And then when there were no women around and Moses was writing this down, that's how it happened, right? It's sort of a funny, like, you know, sometimes when you do a postmortem on something, you're like, what went wrong here? You're like, well, before we even get to like blame, let me just understand how did it happen that God's like, okay, well, here's how it happened. And the message seems to be, you know, there's this like phrase like nothing about us without us. It's like the message seems to be like, actually, Moses was incapable of remembering the women when the women were not around. Like, well, I don't know, there were no women around, so it just didn't occur to him to have to write about women. Okay, so now we're gonna get like, well, here's the fallout of the fact that there were no women around.
And so Moshe wrote the men to keep the Shabbat in a masculine pronoun. And because he was not Mu'av im ha-Briot, engaged with the people, Briot in the feminine, for he had not been with his wife Zipporah for a long time. He did not remember that women too have desire. So he did not include them in the prohibition not to covet.
Somebody was saying, oh yeah, I think it was you, Sarah, right? It was like, well, women don't have feelings. It's like, well, actually, in particular, that one, like, not only were the women not around, but it was like, he's not really familiar with his wife's urges because he actually has been separated from her for so long that he doesn't have the ability to write this piece. I don't know what I think of this. Like, I struggle with this actually as sort of every time I read it of like, is this an excuse? Is this a critique? Is this like a, oh, well, okay, now I understand. Like, that's why it's in that, you know, I don't know whether this makes it better for me, but it's interesting. It's not, this is not my favorite part of the Midrash, but I'm curious if anyone else has like this really, you have some understanding of it, you can help me figure out what's happening. Okay, let's do the next.
The young woman asked the Holy Blessed One, if so, and Moses, who separated from women, could not hear the words which the Holy Blessed One ordained for him, will a sage who was not separated himself be able to hear?
Okay, so she is now going to bring the ancient problem and say, this is a modern problem. Like, wait a minute, if Moses couldn't figure out how to account for the women when there were no women around, and he was Moshe Rabbeinu, then how is my rabbi, like, how's my local rabbi, you know, meant to, how's my local sage? Like, is he okay? So is, if he didn't separate, like, well, he actually has a wife, like the Rebbetzin is around. So does that mean it's not a problem? Like, it was only a problem for Moses because he separated. What of the ancient problem is going to apply now is her question. And here, I think we really get her God fantasy for the answer here.
The Holy Blessed One's countenance became grave and he answered her thus, any Beit Midrash that has no women, my word will not emerge from there whole.
All right. So here she doesn't mince words. I think this is one of the older Midrashim. I feel like she gets a little more subtle and metaphorical in the newer Midrashim, but in this one, she's really just going to tell you directly what she has to say here, which is, any Beit Midrash that has no women, my word will not emerge from their hole. And she puts it in the mouth of God here, right? That God says, yeah, this is true, actually. If women aren't in the Beit Midrash, that we're not going to get the full story. I actually like to teach, sometimes I teach as a class, as a set, this Midrash with the Sinai, with the Mieldot, the midwife's midrash that we studied for those who were here last week. I teach those together as like two different approaches to feminist Torah. That this one, the message is like, women belong in the Beit Midrash. If you want women's revelation, they need to be giving kashias. They need to be asking the questions. They need to be in the Beit Midrash. And the other one as a like, okay, not everyone finds revelation in the same way. Sometimes women find revelation in the birthing process. And maybe like women have a different kind of revelation to bring to the world. And we don't want a feminist Torah that just puts women into the Beit Midrash asking halachic questions. We also want a feminist Torah that says God shows up in the world, you know, through babies and birthing babies. And so like, I think that they're really interesting pair of Midrashim, this one and that one, to put together. Let's get a new reader to read this second Midrash. This is a much newer Midrash, and it's a much more, I think, complicated, Midrashically complicated. And I just think it's brilliant. I'm just so excited to share it with you all. This is a Bereishit Gan Eden text. Quote, and he stationed east of the Garden of Eden the cherubs and the fiery ever-turning sword. Okay, this verse may be in the category of what? You never noticed it in the Torah, because it's like a very interesting and strange verse, right? That when Adam and Chava, when Adam and Eve leave the Garden of Eden, and you know, the entrance to the Garden of Eden, God places at the entrance to the Garden of Eden a fiery, ever-turning sword. Okay, this is, believe it or not, actually a quote from the Torah, from Bereishit Gimel. So you can go back and read about that, but she's going to play with the idea of this fiery, ever-turning sword. And then she's also going to play with this verse from Psalms that translates to, for I am limping on my side and my pain is with me always. She has this Amra Tamar. Tamar says, I keep meaning to ask her, like, is she the Tamar in the Tamar says? Like, this is something that she's saying. I need to figure out also, and or if that's a quote from somewhere, but it is also a quote from Tehillim. Okay, so these are the two verses she's going to play with, and we'll go paragraph by paragraph, and I'll do some explaining.
The Holy Blessed One planted Adam in the Garden of Eden and said, "Let the one created in my image come and do all that I did. Work it as it is said of me." And God saw all that he had made, Bereshit 1:31, "Guard it as it is said of me." God protects the simple. "Let him not eat of the tree of knowledge, so that he not die, as is said of me. And the Lord God truly is a living God." And at the moment that the Holy Blessed One said to him, "Do not eat of it," that Adam not feel so that he not die, Adam fell silent and his soul fell silent too.
Okay. Here's what we're going to take from this. This is a giving over of a creation story where God is trying to make Adam like God, right? We getting all this repetition. I think that's the point of what you're supposed to get from this paragraph, okay? God says, I work, so you work. I guard, so you guard. I live, presumably, eternally. I'm eternal. Therefore, you are eternal, okay? The point of what God is trying to do is to make Adam like God. And then she has this really interesting phrase at the end, right? That Adam not, that he can't eat of the tree, that Adam not feel so that he not die. She links feeling and mortality, it seems like. And then the response to this decree that he has to be immortal, it's like he's giving up feelings at the same time. And then we are told Adam fell silent and his soul fell silent too. I'm curious, when we get to the end, I'll be curious to hear like thoughts on what you think this means. I feel like she's trying to tell us like, this is a muted life, right? A life where you are immortal with everlasting life has less emotional resonance. And that is a muted life that makes Adam silent. There is something that sort of shuts him up in that decision that God is making. Okay. So this is like a really striking setup here for the first paragraph. Again, HaKadosh Baruch Hu with Adam mirroring each other. Okay.
The Holy Blessed One said, "It is not good for Adam to be alone. I will make a helping match for him." God fashioned from the ground all the beasts of the field and all the birds of the sky and said, "Let the one created in my image come and do all that I did and give them names, as it is said of me." And he declared their name Adam on the day that they were created. Adam declared names, but did not find a helping match for himself, and he spiraled downward and downward into silence, until he found himself in a great crater alone.
Okay. So God wants Adam to have an ezer kenegdo, right? A counterpart. And he doesn't find a counterpart. And that this experience of like searching for the counterpart and not finding a counterpart leads Adam down into this depression. So she builds for us this great crater and he's levat. He's alone. Again, you'll see themes in Tamar's Midrashim. The Miriam also, obviously the first Midrash we studied together, had a significant theme of loneliness and what does it mean to be alone. Here, Adam is alone because he didn't find his ezer kenegdo. And I think we're sort of intentionally translating the Adam as they here on the day that they were created, because this is there's sort of two creation stories. This is the Adam that has like maybe both genders within. So you'll see that in the next paragraph.
The Holy Blessed One could not bear to witness his own suffering reflected back to him. The Holy Blessed One brought sleep down upon Adam. Once Adam's limbs relaxed, the Holy Blessed One took an ever-turning sword and cut him along his side. He brought the female side to the male side and stood from afar to see what would become of them.
So here's what's happening. God could not bear to witness his own suffering reflected back. Okay. The first paragraph told us that God is very intentionally creating a mini God, right? God is trying to make Adam like God. And then God realizes, oh, I also made Adam like me in loneliness, right? God is alone and Adam is alone. And God says, I don't want to see that loneliness reflected back at me. So that is what causes God to like put Adam to sleep. And here she uses this image of the ever-turning sword as the thing that is going to like take this one creation image and split it into two. And we're going to have a male and a female side. And they are going to come together and not be alone anymore. Okay. They become one flesh. Okay. So it's a little bit complicated of an image, but you understand what's happening here. We took the motivation for why God wants to create woman is so that man is not alone like God. And the method is using this fiery ever-turning sword that she brings in as an image to make this sort of divide. Okay, it's a little trippy. I guess we have two magical realism kind of, less on the realism, more on the magical on this side. Okay, and let's see what happens here. Now the first, this is where you need to say, and God was left alone. But you have a terrible. Okay.
And God was left alone, and he wailed and beat his heart, for I am nearly limping on my side, and my pain is with me always. How can I, alone and by myself, meet my other side? Let the one created in my image come and do all that I did. Draw the sword and slice me in half and bring the other side to me. And the Lord God called out to Adam and said, where are you? And he stationed east of the Garden of Eden, the cherubs and the fiery ever-turning sword. And he waited.
All right. This is how she ends it.
Oh,
so we'll dig in. This is my, like, these two midrashim are asking versions of what is God waiting for from us. Here's the answer. God looks at Adam and says, like, oh, I want that, right? I split Adam into two and now they're parallel. I want that also. And then God sort of says here, like, God wants to be in touch with God's feminine side, right? Like, there is no feminine side to God. And God says, like, I need you, Adam. I've been training you to do the kinds of things that I, God, do. I did this for you, Adam, and I need you to do this for me. And so God here, like the Ayeka, right? Where are you that God is crying out to Adam is to say, like, Adam, I need you to help humans. I need you to help me. And what God needs from humanity, right? From Adam is to sort of like liberate God's feminine side that is otherwise not there so that God can have this more complete this feeling of completeness and lack of loneliness that God has now. And how does God sort of give the invitation is that God's, when they leave the Garden of Eden, God places the ever-turning sword right at the entrance, sort of like on the outside, not as a threat or to keep them out of the Garden of Eden, but as a request here that God is leaving that sword there to say, help me, come and help liberate my feminine half, so to speak. And God leaves the sword there as sort of this open question, and then God waits. So I think, and I'm happy to hear your reads of this midrash, that like this midrash is ending as saying, like the invitation to us is to say, this is on us. Like if we are looking at a tradition that has only a male God, and we see that like not only are we maybe yearning for a feminine God, but that God is yearning to sort of liberate that side of God's self, and that God needs us to do that work, and that's work that you do like outside of the garden of Gan Eden. That's work you do outside of the garden. It's a very complex, I think, kind of brilliant read that digs into a lot of questions about God's gender, about what it means to be created in the image of God, about what it means for the relationship between us and God, about what it means to have emotions, what it means to be mortal. You know, if we do this surgery on God, will that somehow make God mortal also? Is that part of this, of what she's trying to say here? There's like so much in this Midrash. It's not the tightest Midrash in that there are Midrashim that are like, really, I'm just doing a close reading and I'm taking no creative license. I feel like the first of the two we read today, of all the Dershuni Midrashim that I read and teach, sort of feels like it has the most, it's the most outside the text, meaning it's not even really in the text, it's really in our lives. You know, is really, I feel like it's almost autobiographical. It's like a dream that she had or something, a dream sequence. The second one is like, yeah, it does feel, it's not the tightest Midrash. It's taking like some creative liberties, but I just think that she does take these aspects of the text that meant nothing to me before and make them so meaningful. Like, I didn't know what that ever turning sword was. Had never really given it very much thought. You know, there's a Dershuni Midrash that Tamar Biala wrote that is entirely on the birds in the Noah story, just the dove and the raven. And what was the experience of the dove and the raven? And it's like, well, nobody's ever asked that because, you know, that's really a like, it's, and in that Midrash, it's set in the Beit Midrash of the birds. It's like, well, there's a whole bunch of questions we could be asking that if we were birds, we would want to know what happened to the birds, right? But we don't ask those questions because we're not birds, except that Tamar is able to like see all these things in Torah that we wouldn't otherwise see. We're going to have to stop because it's 5, but this has been so delightful. I really have loved getting a chance to do this learning with you all. And I highly encourage you to keep exploring Dershuni, maybe with a chavruta. Again, you can find it all on Safaria and you can buy the English translation. It's like a Brandeis University Press. And I wish everyone a good end to your summer and more Torah learning ahead for you.